This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet on the 13th day of June, 2022. And in a few moments, the committee in Washington, the bipartisan committee, seven Democrats, two Republicans, Liz Cheney is the vice chair, and Benny Thompson of Mississippi is the chair of this panel that is looking into what happened in the insurrection of January 6th, 2021, a year, 5 months, and 7 days ago. And last Thursday was a compelling night. And for those who missed it, perhaps the most persuasive argument that the election was not stolen was made by none other than the daughter of the guy who said over and over, lying, saying that the election was stolen. This was an election won by Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., 51.3% to 46.9% in the overall vote, a 4.4% gap, which is much bigger than most presidential elections of recent vintage. More than 7 million more voters cast ballots for Biden than for Trump. And Biden won no state by fewer than 10,000 votes. So as Bill Barr put it, the attorney general for Donald Trump, who was devoted to the 45th president in ways that went above and beyond the call of duty, he still called Trump's allegations BS, and he used the full term. And here's how Ivanka Trump responded when she was asked about what Attorney General Barr said regarding his assessment of the election of 2020.
Is the president's daughter commenting on Bill Barr's statement that the department found no fraud sufficient to overturn the election?
How did that affect your perspective about the election when Attorney General Barr made that statement?
It affected my perspective. I respect Attorney General Barr. So I accepted what he was saying.
There you go. Ivanka Trump accepted Bill Barr's assessment that Donald Trump's assertion that the election was stolen was BS. And yet, Ivanka Trump, who's perhaps the closest person on the planet to Donald Trump, was not duped. But in our congressional delegation, John Kennedy was duped. He voted to negate the election. Garrett Graves was duped. He voted to negate the election. So did Steve Scalise. So did Mike Johnson. So did Clay Higgins. Bill Cassidy didn't. So Bill Cassidy comes across as a person who has some reasonable framework as far as how he views big political decisions. He's a conservative, no doubt about it. We were seeing that on guns, although we'll talk later about the senator, the senior senator from Louisiana, being among 20 senators that agreed on a framework for gun safety. It's really, for the most part, window dressing, but at least it's something. At least there is some aspect of a bipartisan deal, which, of course, is being slammed by the major gun groups. And Bill Cassidy, as we know, has received $2.9 million from the National Rifle Association. He was on that panel, as was Mitt Romney, who's received more than $13 million from the NRA. So there's much on the menu today. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. Talk at talklouisiana.org. In a few moments, we're going to hear from Mike Wolf, who is the lawyer who has followed the redistricting lines for Congress in Louisiana, I think closer than anyone, and he has some thoughts about this special session that will start Wednesday in Louisiana, in which the Louisiana legislature has been ordered by Judge Shelley Dick to redraw the lines, and yesterday the Fifth Circuit didn't stop that scenario from going forward. So as of now, Wednesday, the lawmakers return to the Capitol, and they have to do some substantial work in a short time, and we'll discuss it with Mike Wolf. As mentioned, this week there are going to be three hearings regarding the 1-6 Commission, and people are excited and enthused and concerned and interested. So as a result, we may be preempted, and it's a tough call for the station manager, I understand. I've been in his shoes, Paul Mawson, and I get a lot of emails from people, some saying, Jim, we'd love you, but we understand the situation, and others saying we'd prefer to hear you. So really, those emails should go to Paul. So if you have an observation, Paul loves to get emails at paul@wrkf.org. So there you go. If you have a comment about any interruption of regular programming, that's fine. But a reminder that these broadcasts are available online, so you'll be able to hear in that way at wrkf.org and at talklouisiana.org, and you'll be able to hear the show at 9 o'clock at night if you so choose. So we hope you'll be with us in one way or another, but we fully understand the magnitude of the hearings, and these are there is an analogy to what happened in 1973 when the Watergate hearings were in full bloom and ultimately led to the resignation of Richard Milhouse Nixon on 9 August 1974 as the 37th American president. Over the weekend, I had the honor of eulogizing my friend Bud Johnson, who was the LSU Sports Information Director from 1966 to 71. He died June 5th, 88 years old, and what a life he led. Served as country with distinction in the U.S. military, one wife. We're getting some interruption here, so I'm hearing Liz Cheney in my earphones. There we go. Okay. Evelyn, his lovely wife of 61 years, was there, as was his daughter Marcia, his son-in-law Scott at St. Albans Church, and their kids, Lee and Brady. And Bud, of course, was a family guy, and he did that well. He did everything well, but most notably, he became Assistant Sports Information Director at LSU in 1958, February 1st, just before the Tigers won the national title that year. And Bud, many years later, wrote the definitive book about that season, The Perfect Season. And Bud Johnson became extremely close to the guy who was the signature player for the 58 champions, Billy Cannon, as well as Pete Maravich. And when Bud left the SID office as the leader in 1971, it was right after Pete Maravich had hightailed it to the NBA, playing for the Atlanta Hawks. Now, Bud worked for a few years for Eastern Airlines. He came back to Louisiana as the public relations director for the New Orleans Jazz, which were forming in 1974, playing at the Loyola Fieldhouse first. And this was before the Superdome opened, and Pistol Pete was the star player, so Pete and Bud were united. And it was none other than Marvin Lafayette Bud Johnson who named the team the New Orleans Jazz. I think it was Sports Illustrated once noted that the best sports team name of all time was the New Orleans Jazz, and perhaps the worst is the Utah Jazz. But Bud had many interests that went beyond the games people play. He was a guy who was fascinated with life and politics and music, and there wasn't anything in the world that he did not find curious. And his intellectual curiosity was another enormous gift that Marvin Bud Johnson had. And one of his pursuits was jazz, and it was Marvin Bud Johnson who turned me on to Bill Evans, the great pianist who went to college at Southeastern Louisiana University. Bill Evans was actually from New York and New Jersey, but he came to Southeastern and graduated in 1950. And at 21 years old, he went off to the world and became perhaps the greatest pianist of his generation, and he performed with Miles Davis. And in 1959, with Miles Davis, Bill Evans, the kid from SLU, combined with Miles Davis and produced the greatest jazz-selling album of all time. It remains that today. Kind of Blue. And here is a sampling of Bill Evans at the piano and Miles Davis, Kind of Blue. And we have the wrong audio here, so let's see what we can do with Kind of Blue, if we can. Robin Dow's producing. She's doing everything she can, but Liz Cheney wants to come back for some reason, and I don't know why, but that album from trumpeter Miles Davis employed one of the most acclaimed and profitable hard pop bands, Bassist Paul Chambers had been with the band from its beginning in 1955. Alto saxophonist Cannonball Adderley was there, as well as John Coltrane. So it was a galaxy of stars in Kind of Blue. And perhaps, I tell you what, let's just see if we can get it later in the show. I think we've got Liz Cheney all wound up and ready to come back, and I understand that, but we'll have more from the 1-6 Commission as we move along today. There is much on the menu, and before we go to the break, let's introduce Mike Wolf, no stranger to Talk Louisiana, the libertarian lawyer. And Mike, we're a few seconds from going to our first break, but it is significant that lawmakers will be coming to the Capitol, presumably to draw new congressional lines this week.
Yes, yes. They're finally going to have to try to undo the mess they've made of redistricting in recent years.
Well, let's talk about that when we return. Again, 877-217-5757, your number. Back with more Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Story today, front page of The Advocate: ruling to put redistricting session back on track. Federal appeals court lifts delay. A federal appeals court Sunday, writes Wilson Tell and Mark Ballard, lifted a delay on a lower court ruling ordering new Louisiana congressional districts, meaning a special session set to start Wednesday appears to be back on track. Republicans in the legislature had been hoping the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals would stay a lower court's ruling and obviate the need for the special session. The appellate court temporarily did so late Thursday night, but by Sunday, after reviewing arguments and opinions, the court found the state and the legislature have not met their burden of making a strong showing of likely success on the merits. It means the legislature may be forced to reconvene just 9 days after finishing a 3-month regular session, and whether lawmakers will start grappling with new maps or opt to wait for a ruling on the merits of the case is unclear. But Judge Shelley Dick has won round one because she says the districts drawn by the Louisiana legislature, the 6 congressional districts, are patently unfair, because it only has one black majority district in a state with 1/3 of its population African American. Mike Wolf, your thoughts?
Well, it's a fascinating matter. I studied Judge Dick's decision over the weekend, all 152 pages of it. And by the way, I'm right now 1/3 through the Court of Appeal opinion. It was a 30-page opinion. The most striking thing from these cases is that the state did a terribly bad job of justifying their reapportionment activities, the redistricting plan that was approved by the legislature this summer, vetoed by Governor Edwards, and then passed over his veto, was almost an identical continuation of the existing plan, the plan that was enacted 10 years ago after the 1990 census, I mean, the 2010 census. And it is a clear case of racial gerrymandering. If it had been attacked on that basis, these districts would have been thrown out long ago. But nobody brought a suit to do that. But anyway, the courts have said that Judge Dick said that the legislature must go back and create another black majority district, another segregated district. I call them segregated districts, like the second district, because they pack blacks into one district and try to make a super black majority. That is one way you can satisfy the Voting Rights Act, but it is not necessary. It is not demanded by the Voting Rights Act. And that's part of the fascinating set of legal questions that these cases pose. The legislature has now the opportunity to draw reasonable districts, and we're all going to have to sit on the edges of our seats to see what they're going to do about it.
Well,
the thing is, there's a question of whether the districts are sufficiently compact and whether there's a black population that is geographically concentrated enough that it makes sense to have a supermajority black district. And the state hardly even contested that issue. They simply relied on the fact that you shouldn't draw racial lines. And they're two different principles in the law. One is that you shouldn't discriminate against blacks, and the other is that you shouldn't enact racial categories.
Well, the legislature did exactly that a decade ago when they put North Baton Rouge into the district now represented by Troy Carter. It's absolutely ridiculous, and it's done so to try to put as many black people in the state in one district to make all the others Republicans. Now, somebody, if this goes forward, will be nailed, it would seem, that if Garrett Graves had a majority black district, he would not win. If Julia Letlow had a majority black district, she would not win. And if this goes forward, one of those members will likely lose their district, meaning they either have to sit this one out or run in another district. Garrett Graves, for example, could challenge Mike Johnson. He could challenge Steve Scalise. He could challenge Clay Higgins if he wanted to. As a member of Congress, you don't have to live in your district. But it is fascinating. Black residents make up 31% of the state's voting age population, but black voters only control 17% of the congressional district. Meanwhile, white voters make up 58% of the population and form a majority in 83% of the five districts that are represented by white Republicans. 817-217-5757. Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana, you're on with Mike Wolf. Good morning, Henry.
Morning, Mr. Jim. Morning, Mr. Mike. I just remember while all these maps were being drawn, the head of the Republican Senate caucus, whatever, that old woman Sharon Hewitt from over on the North Shore, she said that they had to keep it to one black district because black folks couldn't be counted on to vote for a black representative. Now, have you ever heard anything so crazy in all your life? I hope she goes and tells that to the Court of Appeal.
No, wait a minute. What did you say, that blacks couldn't be counted on to do what?
To vote for a black, they couldn't be counted on to vote for a black person in a majority black district. Which has nothing to do with what the rules are. You know, it just has black representation, not blacks electing a black.
All right, well,
I mean, Lindy Boggs was a great representative for her district,
which was majority black.
Right.
But at that time, she was the only white person representing a majority black district in America. Now, Gary Forster.
She did a hell of a job.
Gary Forster, who's a, now a, he's an, I mean, you talk about a guy who's to the right of to the right. He is, but he was a state lawmaker in New Orleans representing a majority black district for several terms. But Mike, do you have any thoughts about Henry's statement?
Yes, this is the question of racially polarized voting. And it's very important under the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on the Voting Rights Act. In East Baton Rouge, for example, we have a lot of what's called crossover voting between races. White people will vote for black candidates. Statewide, by the way, blacks are less likely to vote for white candidates than whites are to vote for black candidates. But these demographers that Shelley Dick paid attention to called Baton Rouge an outlier that shouldn't even be considered. Those things are ridiculous. The thing to emphasize about this is that proportional representation is not demanded. That is, if blacks are one-third of the population, they're not entitled to have one-third of the representatives, because if they're spread evenly through the state, just for one reason, then they'd only be a third of every district. They wouldn't have a majority in any of them. And it's ridiculous to have people like the governor and judges repeating that mistake.
Well, but Mike, we're gone. They don't even have a shot. That's just it. It's not just the fact that we don't have two black majority districts. They don't even have a chance, because the lawmakers are doing everything they can to prevent them from having that chance.
I agree with that. And the districts that have been drawn are totally unreasonable.
All right. Okay. You're wound up. We got some people I want to get in. 877-217-5757. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Mike Wolf. Good morning.
Good morning. Is there a chance we could actually get six districts, each more evenly divided between white and black voters, and thus diminish the extremists who are only worried about being primary?
Well, yes, we can get reasonable districts if we would base districts on geography, like the third district, for example. There should be a district based in New Orleans, a district based in Baton Rouge, a district based in North Louisiana and in Southwest Louisiana, and a Central Louisiana district. But the problem is that the legislature's only principle was preserving the status quo. That's what they did. They wanted to preserve the incumbents' districts. And the new map they passed, they enacted, and the governor vetoed, was almost identical to the map we've had for the last 10 years. And that's the mistake. They don't have the guts to draw reasonable districts.
And one of the reasons is that these Congress people are down there leaning on them, telling them to keep things the way they are. They like the things the way they are. And by the way, that includes the Democrat, too. Troy Carter, his hands are not clean on this either. He likes the district he has.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you often in the past have referred to this the status quo as a Republican gerrymander. That's only partly right, because the black caucus and the Democrats wanted it just as much as the Republicans.
10 years ago, but that's not the case now. That although Troy Carter, having won in that district, he likes what he has. But it's not the case now with the legislature, the Black Caucus at all. And we'll talk more with Mike after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. And in 2 days, when the governor will be doing his monthly radio show, Ask the Governor, that same day, lawmakers are scheduled to convene in Baton Rouge for a special session unless something changes on redistricting, because U.S. District Judge Shelley Dick of Baton Rouge issued an opinion a week ago today saying the legislature drew the districts in Congress were unfair and do not comply with the Voting Rights Act. And as a result, they're back at the Capitol. Now, they could defy the judge, and a listener asked Mike Wolf, before we go back to the phones, again, your number 877-217-5757, and emails talk@talklouisiana.org. What happens if lawmakers defy the judge's order? Does the judge get to draw the districts then?
Yes, indeed. The judge will draw the districts. That's right. It'll go back to Shelley Dick.
Okay. Miriam in Mandeville says blacks are not spread evenly throughout the state, and those who oppose redistricting to at least make it possible for there to be more black elected representation purposely ignores the deep past of institutional discrimination based on race. That's something we were reflecting on, is that it's hard because of the way the black population is configured in Louisiana, where it's located, that it's a little harder to draw these districts that are fair if you want to have 4 white and 2 black districts, if that's what we're looking at. But Mike, I've said many times that Baton Rouge has a population that is 46% African American, is not a majority black, East Baton Rouge Parish. But yet we, on 5 straight occasions, 5 in a row, we have elected black mayors. We did so in 2004, 2008, 2012, 2016, and 2020. Would it be possible for a district that was not over 50% black to pass muster?
Yes, it definitely would be. All that is necessary is that the blacks have a reasonable opportunity, comparable to the opportunities of other ethnic groups, to elect candidates of their choice. So yes, and in fact, the recent decision in Alabama, which is cited by these federal courts in the Louisiana case, was very clear on that point. It does not need to be a black supermajority for it to be a reasonable opportunity district for blacks. And as I was saying when I lost contact, that if you had a district based in Baton Rouge and a district based in New Orleans, each of one of those would be approximately half and half black and white. They'd be perfect black opportunity districts.
But if it's half and half, you would take the risk of, let's say, possibly having every district white. It might be a white Democrat, might be a white Republican, but it is sometimes hard to be totally fair in these matters.
Well, yes. But again, the legislature isn't trying to create reasonable districts at all. Again, they packed all the blacks, and the blacks wanted it, a supermajority district, a segregation district, so they would just have to talk to black people and you know, don't have to deal with the whites or the minority groups in their district. That's terrible, just as it is when they were denying the vote to blacks. So, yes, we have a terrible history of racial discrimination in this state, but we can get straight at some point, and we ought to be doing it now.
Well, here we have a city of Baton Rouge, which is a blue city. I think that's apparent by the fact that Kip Holden won the mayor's race three times and Sharon Weston Broom has twice. And yet we have a congressman who is from Baton Rouge, Garrett Graves, who voted to negate the presidential election, voted against the impeachment of Donald Trump twice, voted against the commission to investigate the insurrection of January 6th, voted against the infrastructure money, voted against aid to Ukraine. You go down the list, voted against the gun bill last week that does not even include an assault weapons ban. He does not represent most of the people in East Baton Rouge Parish in their thinking. He represents most of the people in the state of Louisiana in their thinking. So should members of Congress be beholden to the state as a whole, or should they be beholden to the people in their district? Or do you have an opinion one way or the other on that?
Yeah, I would say categorically, you couldn't say one or the other. They're supposed to do what's right and just. And by the way, it is important to emphasize that we're talking about East Baton Rouge Parish, and actually any congressional district would have to be much larger because it would have to reach the population requirement for a congressional district. And so it would be white majority probably, but it'd be close. And yes, it would be a black opportunity district. And but still, most of the area, the region, votes for Republican. You know, we recognize that.
Sharon Hewitt, who's been mentioned a time or two this morning, the state lawmaker who carries the responsibility in the Senate for these districts, says, and I think she's totally accurate in this, the Fifth Circuit in its decision yesterday did not consider the merits of the case. So what does that mean? They basically let this go forward, but the merits as far as whether these statements by Judge Dick are accurate, what do you think?
Well, yes, the merits have not been reached, but they do discuss the merits. The merits haven't been resolved. In order to decide whether to grant an injunction, they must rule that the plaintiffs seeking an injunction are likely to succeed on the merits. So because of that, and considering whether to issue a stay, they have to predict who will win on the merits question. And that's why in this 30-page Fifth Circuit opinion, they do discuss the merits, and they discuss this question of whether the black proposed black districts are sufficiently compact to be reasonable under traditional redistricting principles. And those traditional principles require that there be communities of interest that are respected, and that cities and local communities aren't routinely separated, for example, or unusually combined, like putting Baton Rouge and New Orleans together. Well, in these darn districts that they proposed, the plaintiffs in the case proposed illustrative districts to give examples of what they would like to do. And all of them favored expanding the present fifth district to include, to make it a black majority district. They want to take parts of Baton Rouge and combine them with Northeast Louisiana, with St. Landry Parish, with parts of Lafayette, and they make just a horrible gerrymander to accomplish that. And, right, and that's not required.
I love your passion on this. I don't know anybody who gets worked up more on redistricting than lawyer Mike Wolf, but based on what you just told me, it sounds like they have considered the merits. They just haven't ruled on the merits.
Yes, that's partly so. That's partly so. But they've indicated the flaws in Shelley Dick's reasoning, and so much remains to be seen. But the problem is that the courts of appeal, the courts only have the record that was made in Judge Dick's courtroom, and the state dropped the ball. The Secretary of State dropped the ball, the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, and Landry, the Attorney General. None of them put on any case to show the reasonableness of the districts. They just said, we had a right to do this, and what we did is reasonable because it preserves the existing district.
All right, well, then maybe the districts are not reasonable. Maybe that's one of the reasons that they are hard to defend. There's no doubt. It's just basically
they're indefensible. You can't defend them on reasonable grounds. But one of the redistricting criteria that the courts have always allowed is incumbent protection, or preserving the core of pre-existing districts. But as these judges discuss, when you get into these opinions, if you had to made incumbent protection the primary criterion, there would never be a change. You would never, you know, get over segregation and so forth.
All right. But well, anyway, where do you think this is going?
It's going to be very interesting to see. You would hope the legislature would fix things up, but they're not going to do it. I believe they'll continue to be obstinate. Judge Dick is going to have to appoint a special master, and we'll have, like in New York State, what just happened in New York, they're going to have a special master redistrict for the congressional districts in Louisiana, because the legislators won't do it reasonably. That's what's going to happen.
Well, and my guess is that the districts will look much different than the ones that are in play right now. And another listener asked a very good question about why Louisiana's case was allowed to go forward and Alabama's, the court said they didn't have enough time. Well, the reason is because we don't have primaries. We don't have party primaries. We've got lots of time. We don't have an election until November. So there is plenty of time to get this done and give candidates an opportunity to get their ducks in a row, Mike.
Yes, that is the main difference. But incidentally, to show you how off the wall some of the arguments were made in this case, some of the arguments were that were made, the plaintiffs allege that the Louisiana's open primary system is racially discriminatory because and with our nonpartisan primaries, often the final election runoff is between two white candidates. And, you know, sometimes it isn't, but they actually say that having an open primary is racist. And I think that's crazy.
Well, that makes no sense at all, because that involves the whole state of Louisiana. And anybody can run who wants to run. Some would say that an open primary is the most democratic way to hold an election.
Indeed. But not the NAACP. They think it's racist.
Well, you know, as you know, you're a good lawyer. Sometimes in court, you say what you can to to try to get your way.
That's right. You throw the kitchen sink in every argument you can make, and that's one they made.
I disagree. Anyway. That's not right. But, Mike, always a pleasure. We'll let you go, and we'll follow this with you, and I'm sure we'll be calling on you again very soon, my friend. Thank you, sir.
I'll get through the rest of it soon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And I did want to note, as we stated at the beginning of the show, that Senate negotiators announced on Sunday they've struck a bipartisan deal on a narrow set of gun safety measures with sufficient support to move through the evenly divided chamber. It's a significant step. 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans put this forward, including one William Morgan Cassidy. It amounts to some progress for those of us who believe that we need to do some things, but it's really window dressing for the most part. But the package does include some measures that that I think people will concur on. They concur on far greater things, but people would have to be 21 to buy a semi-automatic weapon, and it would ban the sale of large-capacity magazines. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we're spending a few minutes with remarkable young writer Janie Victoria Ward. Last month, we had the second anniversary of the killing of George Floyd, and it was an event, as we know, an episode in American history that seared our country, and it seems fitting that we acknowledge projects like the one that our author is involved with, and her book that is done in conjunction with Tracy Robinson Wood is Sister Resistors, Mentoring Black Women on Campus. And good morning to you, Janie Victoria.
Good morning.
Nice to talk
Hello.
With you.
Great to speak with you.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, tell us what's going on college campuses that can facilitate better understanding on the issue of race and on other matters for what we're discussing.
Sure. I'm happy to do so. So I've been teaching for over 35 years on college campuses, colleges and universities, along with my colleague Tracy Robinson. And we teach on predominantly white institutions. And one of the things that colleges have been really focused on in the last few years is recruitment and retention of students of color. And we focus this book specifically on young black women. But, you know, in order to keep black women on campus until they can finish their degrees and help them to develop a sense of belonging to the institution, we have found that there's a lot that institutions still need to do. So often, black students will come and sit down in our offices and share with us some of the real challenges that they're dealing with on campus.
Well, what are some of those challenges? What are some of the primary challenges that they tell you about, Janie?
Yeah, so sometimes it's about instances of blatant racism. But, you know, fortunately, that is not always the case. At other times, there are these what we call microaggressions, where things are happening to students that are disconcerting, throw them off balance, and can really cause some real psychological distress. For instance, students who may have unusual names that professors just can't seem to figure out how to pronounce. Students who talk about walking across campus and being assumed to be the housekeeping staff. Students feel that there are people, maybe other white students, who are communicating to them that they're taking the place of a more deserving white student. And of course, there are those stereotypic misrepresentations of black women, that we are loud, that we are potentially violent, that we're mean. So these are the kinds of things that young black women are navigating on predominantly white institutions.
All right. The book is Sisters Resisters, Sister Resisters. And you said there are some cases of blatant racism that you encounter and hear of others. What are some of those instances?
Yeah, well, you know, there are the stories that crop up just about every year of sororities or fraternities having parties. Perhaps they're in blackface. Perhaps they are assuming some other kind of stereotypic representation of black people. The sorority or fraternity members may think they're being funny. And, you know, with enough beer and wine, a lot of really stupid behavior can be assumed to be funny. But it's really offensive, right? So those are the kinds of incidents where people are making fun of other people. And then they turn and they say, oh, come on, why are you so sensitive? Or, you know, I'm your friend. I take that biology class with you. Why would you assume that I am being racist?
Right? All right.
And that can be, you know, for a black student, you're trying to figure out, well, are you really my friend? And if I walk away, or you're around your white friends, are you thinking about me in the same way, holding me in the same high regard that you do with your white friends? So those are some examples of the kinds of relational issues that crop up on college campuses.
Well, I attended, graduated from Louisiana State University, was not a member of the Greek system, but it's still there, and it's a big part of campus, and the fraternities and sororities, for the most part, are segregated now, as they have been for a century or so. There's a new president at LSU, a black man, William Tate, and when I asked him if he was going to delve into that, my indication from him is that he's not, that some things are just, that it's just not worth the fight. What do you think?
Well, you know, far be it for me to tell a college president how to run his institution, but I think that his response is really important for our conversation, and that is that whether professors, college administrators, staff in the college are focused on eliminating racism or not, students themselves, who are the people who have to navigate all of this, have to develop what we call resistance strategies to overcome some of these problems that are out there. So whether the institution is focused on it, the student whose lived experience is one in which she has to deal with racism had better figure out good strategies to do so. And when we wrote the book, we were thinking a lot about mentors in students' lives. Those mentors are often faculty members, or they are administrators, or other staff people. Sometimes they've been assigned to a student. You know, you need to work with this student to help her to understand what she needs to do in order to become a nurse, right? Or some other pre-professional program. And we wanted to write a book for those mentors out there who are working with young Black women who have a sense that, you know, her experience might be different than a white woman going through this school, but I'm not really sure of what those differences are, and I'm not sure how best to serve this young woman.
Well, we thank you for joining us. Janie Victoria Ward, along with Tracy Robinson, has written Sister Resistors. Thank you for your comments and appreciate your insights, Janie. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you.
And as we round the corner and head for home, earlier I was talking about my late great friend Bud Johnson, who died at 88, former LSU sports information director, the guy who was there for Billy Cannon and Pistol Pete. And in 2011, when LSU celebrated its 150th anniversary, the 150 most influential people in sports selected by a panel at LSU were Billy Cannon and Pete Maravich, the two people who were at the bookends of Bud Johnson's career. But I was noting that he was an enthusiast of many passions in life, including jazz, and he was very proud that his alma mater produced one, Bill Evans, who's buried at Roselawn Memorial Cemetery here in Baton Rouge, died at 51 in 1980 of cirrhosis of the liver. But he was the guy at the piano for the greatest selling jazz album of all time, Kind of Blue, with Miles Davis in 1959. And John Coltrane is in that group. Cannonball Adderley. It was an amazing collection of talent. And I've gotten more than a few responses already from listeners, including this one from Bill Huey, saying, Bill Evans is my all-time favorite jazz pianist. Did you know he's buried in Roselawn on North Street under a spreading oak next to his brother Harry? Harry taught music in Baton Rouge Public Schools and had a jazz trio in the 60s. I visit Bill and Harry whenever I go to Roselawn to visit my grandparents. That from Bill Huey. But I have to thank Bud Johnson for many things in my life because he was a great friend of mine, but he turned me on to one Bill Evans, who, when he was still in his late 20s, was at the piano for the number one jazz-selling album of all time, Kind of Blue. And here is Bill Evans with Miles Davis. Thank you for joining us today. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Stay safe and stay tuned.